Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show podcast online at edexcellence.net. Please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Brad Pitt of Education Policy, Rick Hess.
Mikey.
How
good to
are
see you, babe.
How you doing, Rick?
I'm good. I am not Brad Pitt, though. Brad Pitt, it came out, of course, was actually schnookering with Angelina Jolie during Mr. and Mrs. Smith, previously denied it.
I know, and he was at the time married, right?
At the time, to Jen Aniston.
Yeah.
Who cheats with Jennifer Aniston?
I know, I'm still upset about that.
Not only is she beautiful, not only is she that great butterscotch hair,
yeah,
but she was America's sweetheart. She still is.
Yeah, I know. So what
was
he
cheating
thinking?
On Julia Roberts.
Is he, he's just a bad boy on his motorcycle and all? He just... He can act though, man. So, Rick, I understand you spent the weekend at Walt Disney World.
No, I actually spent at Universal Studios in Islands of Adventure.
Oh, interesting. Oh, is there? Did you have a favorite ride that you got to?
They got this new Simpsons ride, this virtual 3D coaster where you stay in place, but really phenomenal graphics and kind of motion move stuff. Really cool.
Okay. All right. Well, we got lots to cover today, Rick, because things are finally happening. Things are happening. We're after the election. We're into the transition. Everybody's trying to have an impact on the new team, and there's lots to talk about. So we're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We are going to hear Amber with her research minute. She did, you know, research 50 seconds last week.
Woof. She was better. She gets more information into a smaller amount of time.
It's true. And she's got fans. We keep hearing from Amber's fans out there. People
and most of us get less information into a larger amount of time.
That's what we specialize in, actually.
Yes. What we do.
And then, of course, Stafford will rate that reform. So, Christina, let's get started with Pardon the Gadfly.
Topic one. Fordham came out with a new book this week on education data. That might not sound exciting, but check out our FERPA music video.
It's pretty sweet. It's pretty sweet.
Rick, you had a chapter with John Fullerton about how school districts can use data to improve their performance. Why aren't they doing this already?
That's a really good question. You know, what John and I made the point is we said, look, it's great that we're capturing grade 3 to 8 reading and math scores today. This has been a revolution. This has been a real triumph of No Child Left Behind. And it's great that we care about graduation rates. But if you're trying to figure out, if you're a superintendent, or if you're a principal, or if you're actually working in districts or schools, and you're trying to figure out if your HR team's doing a good job, if you're hiring smoothly and effectively, if you're supporting your people in the schools, grade 3 to 8 reading and math scores don't tell you anything you care about. What you care are measures that reflect how well people do it. Couple problems historically. One is we've always wanted to track the dollars flowing out, so we focused on those. Two, policymakers and parents care about test scores as they should, so we've started to capture that. We've just never spent much time thinking about what do you need to manage and lead schools and systems.
But Rick, isn't the fundamental problem that there are no incentives really for managers in the education system to care about things like efficiency or customer satisfaction? Either they just care about their own sort of bureaucratic goals, or they now increasingly do care about student achievement. But the stuff in the middle, there's just no incentive.
I mean, it's a chicken egg situation. We got principals and district leaders who were never trained into how do you use balanced scorecards or how do you think about these. We never built information systems to capture this stuff. So you're exactly right. So there's nobody's got an awareness or opportunity. Even if you
built that stuff, right? I mean, what superintendent gets a bonus because they found a way to save some money or be more efficient? I mean, does that
nobody
happen?
And that's what shows up when we read about the budget crises that are always cropping up, right? Every time there's an economic downturn. So right now, districts are looking to lop 100, 200 million. Very little attention to where you can wring out new savings. It's always about closing summer school or, you know, closing down special programs. So, yeah, you know, you're exactly right. Incentives are a huge part of this puzzle.
All right.
I always like it when Rick says that I'm exactly right.
You're a smart guy, Mike.
You know, Rick also in Ed Week this week got quoted saying, sure as hell.
There you go.
And I've got to believe that's the first time that Education Week has quoted anybody saying sure as hell. And I'm not surprised that the first time would be Frederick Emmons.
What was I saying in reference to?
Gates, something.
Information from all this money going out.
Oh.
Something about Gates, yeah.
There you
Gates,
go. Yeah.
Okay, Christina, topic number two.
All right. Randy Weingarten gave a big speech on Monday that cast her as a reformer. Meanwhile, it appears that she's trying to scuttle reform here in the Washington, D.C. public schools. Which is the real Randy?
Well, see, this drives me crazy. You know, Checker, after reading about Randy's speech, said, oh, this is so much like an Al Shanker move that, you know, she's talking about, you know, all kinds of reform. She says she's open to anything that's good for kids except for vouchers. And just like Al Shanker used to be very reform-minded, and yet her local affiliates, of course, are pushing against reform. But in this case, it's not just her local affiliates pushing against reform. She's actually teaming up with a local affiliate here in Washington, D.C. to push against reform.
Well, now, hold on. Now, what about Randy's and Michelle's pledge that they're eager to sit down and work out the contract. You don't buy Randy on this?
No, I mean, my guess is that Randy inserted herself into this process because she was worried that her guy on the ground here in D.C. was going to give away too much to Michelle. My sense is that what Randy is all about right now is trying to make sure there's as little reform element in the D.C. teacher contract as possible because, if Michelle Reed gets some sort of performance pay or some sort of concessions in terms of tenure or being able to remove ineffective teachers, that's going to set a precedent for other cities that Randy doesn't want.
So explain to me the logic of Randy going to the press club and making the speech. Doesn't she raise the bar for herself in terms of expectations on reform?
But it's so easy. She can say all she wants on reform. She wants to, she wants the press to believe that she is a reform-minded teacher union person. She's a new kind of teacher union person, regardless of what's actually happening on the ground with her affiliates or what she's doing right here in her own neighborhood in D.C.
Right. I mean, trusting that the speech will get covered, that it's harder for folks to sort out what's actually happening in the nuts and bolts on the ground, which actually means this is, a mission out there for the Greg Tapos and the David Hoffs and the Eric Roblins of the world, that they need to go out and take a look at some of this stuff and see if she's living up on her pledge.
Rick, though, I liked how you got in the names of three of our loyal listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Nicely done.
Hey, we talked to our base, baby.
Yeah, baby. Shouting out.
Last one. Linda Darling Hammond has been appointed as the chief policy czar of the Obama Education Department transition team. Why shouldn't reformers see this as a really, really bad sign of things to come?
Do you like our writing, Rick? Do you like those neutral questions we have?
Well, and I particularly like the groan of pain in the middle of the question.
Although I should say that she has, to Education Week, denied that she's heading the policy team. There's a new list of transition people out today that doesn't have her on it, so there's some confusion about what her role is.
For the first time in the course of the Obama's education team, the reality here is that, as we all know, the Obama team has a huge spectrum of thought when it comes to education. That for all the protestations from the various individuals, that I don't think any of us on the outside have any real sense of where Obama's sympathies lie or who holds the upper hand in these conversations. And to the extent that one or another of these camps winds up making the decisions regarding either policy or personnel out of the box, that's going to look like they're winning the early rounds.
Well, and Linda Darling Hammond keeps popping up everywhere. I mean, yesterday she was at a National Academies event. They're releasing their blueprint for federal policy. She met with the state superintendents the other day. So they're sending her out as their representative to these major events, which certainly sends the signal that she's playing a major role. And this is a horrible... I mean, okay, we all have to say yes. Linda Darling Hammond, she's done some important work in her career. Some of the things that the National Commission on Teaching American Future wanted, on teacher quality wasn't all bad. But she's dead set against alternative certification in teachers. Mm-hmm. Her views on accountability and testing are awfully squishy. She comes out of the ed schools and she's closely aligned with the teachers unions. This cannot be seen as good for reform. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask, where is Andy Rotherham? Where is John Schnur? Why are they getting their butts kicked?
Guys, what's the answer?
I just want them to know that we are rooting for them. There were times I wasn't always sure that they were rooting for us reformers on the Republican side.
Well, although Andy has offered substantial advice as both to where Republicans should go next.
Yes, that's
and,
true.
And, lessons as to from this administration. Just because you guys were clowns doesn't mean...
I wish he'd spend more time trying to win these internal fights in the Obama camp. Okay, well, Amber, welcome back. It is that time to have Amber's Research Minute. Okay, Amber. Well, what are we going to be talking about in the next 60 seconds?
Well, speaking of alternative certification, you gave a little plug there. There's a new study out from Harvard's Ed Policy Shop. It's called What Happens When States Have Genuine Alternative Certification, which I'm going to call AC. It looks at whether state AC programs are in fact really alternative, and if so, whether those programs do a better job recruiting minority teachers and boosting achievement. Researchers found that states with genuine AC programs, meaning the ones where teachers didn't have to take the 30 education credits typically required for certification, had more minority teachers in proportion to their adult minority population than did states with symbolic AC. And this is where teachers still had to take the plethora of education courses. They also found higher NAEP gains in the genuine AC states, so they couldn't control for other state policies that may have also had an impact. So bottom line, if we want to recruit more minority teachers, we need to consider ditching the education courses that, after all, are of questionable value.
Whew. Lightning boom. Speed.
All right, boom. What was my time? Give it to me.
I think it was around 45 seconds.
45 seconds? Don't tell me that. Don't tell me that.
Hold on. When you say Harvard's Education Policy Shop, what is that?
This is Paul Peterson's.
Pepchi. This was published
with
in Education
Next. With our
Fordham
Next Scholar.
This week. Yes.
So we're trying to keep our circle of friends and acquaintances as narrowly drawn as possible.
That's right. Well, hey, this is okay. It's a big study. It's important. So what's the song?
The song, because genuine alternative certification is actually typically better than real certification, we've got U2 even better than the real thing.
Ooh, I like it. I love you too. Anytime that you can get you too on the show,
again,
I'm
this
in favor
props
of it.
To Laura. Gave
Laura,
her a
well
nugget.
Done. Yeah. Well done. Okay, so now part of the study was looking at NAEP scores mm-hmm. and trying to say, well, places that have true alternative certification, what do their NAEP scores look like? Isn't this kind of methodology that we have criticized when other people like Linda Darling Hammond
yes,
try to do this in the past?
It's a little sketchy. I mean, they controlled for things like free and reduced lunch population. They controlled for the demographics, all those typical things that we need to control for. Mm-hmm. But they admit in the study they couldn't look at other state policies that were going on at the same time that may have had an impact, which I tried to plug in there.
Yeah.
I mean, I tried to downplay that part in my 50 seconds or 45 or whatever, because I think the bigger message was the minority teacher finding, because they did use an index that was reasonable. That made sense. The NAEP stuff isn't, I don't think we can stand on that
as much. I think there are opportunity costs to people having to go through taking lots of coursework. It's expensive to take lots of coursework. And so you could imagine that people that, particularly are coming from lower incomes, are not going to be able to sign up for alternative certification programs that are expensive or that are going to require them to spend a lot of time that they could be spending earning a salary.
But importantly, it was also they looked at if you could just take a test. They didn't just define it as you have to take these 30 credits. They also, does a state allow you to take a test? So they didn't give the numbers.
Just to clarify for listeners, did they find that there was a direct causal relationship of your certification policies to your minority teacher workforce? Or do they find that states that happen to have certain kinds of AC policies also happen to have
the latter?
Okay.
Rick, was that a rhetorical question? I mean, you are on the team at Education Next, so did you read
this? Did you read this stuff?
I was just clarifying for folks who may not have had the opportunity.
I think that it's possible. You don't read every word in Education Next.
That's true. Not when it comes up, but I'd read it at some point. But I remembered that. But I just think it's a useful distinction because we do make some of these criticisms of folks doing this work from other vantage points,
right.
And it's important for us all to be clear.
Well, famously, I mentioned Linda Darling Hammond. She, for a long time, was arguing that states that had required NCATE accreditation for their ed schools had higher NAEP scores. Mm-hmm. And, we used to argue, well, come on, that's a tenuous relationship, to try to make the case that that's why their NAEP scores are higher. So.
Well, and this racial composition question, it's interesting that EdNext now finds itself advocating that any policies which are correlated with higher degrees of minority representation are de facto good policies.
Yeah, but, there was an Education Next article that found that, all things being equal, that, African-American kids that had African-American teachers were doing better achievement-wise, right?
It was some reanalyzation of the Tennessee Star study that was...
Oh, is this Tom D's reanalysis?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yep.
Come on, Rick, this is your magazine.
Linda, and Lisa Delpit, too, says that, Rick.
Yes.
I know you love that.
No. I just like it when we're all very kind of even-handed about our methodological kind of, critiques.
All right. Well said. Well, thank you, Amber, and Amber's research, 45 seconds. Okay, it is that time we wait for all week long. It is Rate That Reform time, and Stafford tells me that this week we have a doozy.
It is a doozy. And, I didn't actually realize that Amber was going to be talking about alternative certification because I'm going to be talking about alternative certification, too. And this story comes from Dallas, Texas. We all know that there are some subjects that are harder to staff than others. So back in 2004, the problem for Dallas was bilingual teachers. And since the state is roughly 30% Spanish speaking, you can imagine the plethora of little bilingual tots lacking that nurturing guidance of a native speaker. But basically, DSID DISD, needed bilingual teachers, and they needed them stat. So where do you find native Spanish speakers in Texas? Well, you go to Mexico, of course. Mm-hmm. Find a couple native speakers from across the border, help them get visas, get them into your alternative certification program, and put them in classrooms. All problem solved. Except that you can't put them on the payroll without a social security number. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an easy problem to fix, thought DISD. We'll just give them fake social security numbers. And then after they've applied for the real social security numbers from the Social Security Administration, we'll just do a little switcheroo in the database, and nobody will be the wiser. Except then, DISD had to submit reports to the Texas Workforce Commission, the Department of Homeland Security, and the IRS on their new hires. Yeah. So it seems some of the numbers that were assigned to these bilingual teachers that they brought from across the border had the three-digit prefix 200, which incidentally is the prefix used in Pennsylvania. And it seems some of the numbers actually assigned to DISD's illegal immigrant bilingual teachers already had owners a couple thousand miles away in the Quaker state. Can you imagine? Cute little Miss Johnson applies for the job at the local library. They do a background check on her, you know, just routine, and then they discover that sneaky Mrs. Johnson already is employed in the Dallas school system, except that she's not. But anyway, mm-hmm. seems that the Texas Education Agency discovered the sham in 2004, but DISD kept assigning the fake numbers through the summer of 2007, and apparently their database is such a mess, they don't even know who's a legitimate hire and who's not anymore. No word on the legal consequences forthcoming. Hmm. So, for problem definition, okay, you need bilingual teachers. You want to hire some more bilingual teachers? I understand that. I'll give them an A for that. But for execution, I mean, do I even need to comment? This is just retarded, not to mention illegal. And I am all in support of alternative certification programs, but let's not break the law in the process.
Okay, so now, Stafford, help me understand a little bit. So these teachers were legit, right? They got a visa to come and work in the United States, so that much was okay?
No, they got a visa to come into the United States.
Okay.
It wasn't a working visa.
Ah.
And so they couldn't put them on the payroll because they didn't have a social security number. And it takes too long for them. They needed the teachers immediately. And it took too long because you can apply for a social security number when you come into the U.S.
Right. And you have a green card. And
yeah, exactly.
So these teachers didn't have a green card, basically?
That's what it sounded like. The article is not completely clear. And there's more information forthcoming. But the district was assigning them social security numbers and like putting it in their database, using it in their payroll. So
in effect, these were illegal immigrants that they were hiring?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you get some credit for urgency, you know? I mean, but yes, I guess you're probably right that we should not be violating the immigration laws of our country in order to staff our schools. As a general rule. Good. Well, and I think it's okay that, you know, this talk about alternative certification, you know, particularly minority teachers and alternative certification, you know, I think this kind of gave this today's show a bit of a theme. Absolutely. The other theme it had was about data. So here is another example of a data challenge.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So among all the other things that we've explored this week on the data challenge front, making up social security numbers, not a smart move. Okay, well, thank you, Stafford, for rating that reform. That is all the time we have for this week. Don't forget to join us next time here on the Education Gadfly Show, coming to you from edexcellence.net. Till next week, he was Rick, and I'm Mike of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.